Could we make a start? Thank you very much, everyone, for giving up an evening here in Glasgow to come and fill the fruit market. It is fantastic. There are over 1,000 people here tonight, and we could have filled it several times over, I suspect. Thank you all for coming along. Could I start by saying these meetings and these events don't happen by accident. They happen because a lot of people give up a lot of time and a lot of energy as volunteers to make sure it happens. So can you put your hands together to thank all of our wonderful volunteers for all they've done tonight? And Denise for chairing tonight's event and so many other events that you do so well. Katie, for all your friendship in Parliament, all you did in Parliament, all you do at the moment, and all the contribution you will always make to socialism and the Labour movement at any time in the future. A big thank you to Katie Clark for everything she's done. To Samantha for the great speech she made, that passion, that youth, that vibrancy and that determination. Samantha, thank you very much for what you said and did tonight. To my great friend and fellow cyclist, Owen Jones, for his books, his wit, his humour, his eternal youth, I'm very jealous. And to Neil Findlay, the chair of our campaign in Scotland, one of the great socialists and campaigners, activists, leaders in Scotland. Neil, it's an honour to work with you on this and so many other campaigns. And there are many, many people I want to thank, but Stephen Fraser and Arthur come together and we've named them the Socialist Band. And there are people who've come along here tonight. Many of you, I thank you all for coming, but I want to pay a special thanks to two very, very dear friends of mine, and I'm not allowed to visit Glasgow without seeing them. I'm not allowed to leave the city without eating with them. They always look after me in the most fantastic way. Two wonderful people, brilliant peace campaigners, brilliant socialists who've done so much for so long in Scotland, Alan and Karen McKinnon. And colleagues who were in Parliament until the general election intervened, I want to say a big thank you to Ian Davidson and Mike Connerty for coming along tonight and showing their support for this campaign. This meeting tonight is one of many. And I was just thinking, in the past 6 days, we've had meetings in Bradford, Doncaster, York, Leeds, Llandudno, Shotton, Tredegar, Cardiff. I'm carrying on. Aberdeen, Dundee, Edinburgh, and tonight in Glasgow. Next week, we'll be in Nottingham, we'll be in Manchester, we'll be in London, and the week after that, we're going to be in Plymouth and Truro, and then we're going to Portsmouth, and we're going to every single part of the UK, as many towns and as many cities as we can get to. All the meetings are full, all the places are full. Why? Because I think this campaign offers something very, very different. We came into being because of our anger at the election results and because of our disappointment at the way in which our party presented itself in the election. I'm not here to criticise individuals and I'm not going to do that. But the fundamental message, there was good stuff in the manifesto, no question about that. And I campaigned as hard as anybody to try and get our party elected into government in May. But, and the big but is this, that if all we could offer people was a form of austerity light, of continued wage freezes in the public sector, continued cuts in local government expenditure, continued privatisation to some extent in some of the services, we weren't offering a real challenge to the politics of austerity and the agenda that goes behind it. And that is why we came into forming this campaign in this election. And I'll say more about that in a moment. But our campaign is trying to mobilize people. And to begin with, it was very difficult because there was a sort of gatekeeping role of the Parliamentary Labour Party. Apparently, I've read in some of the papers that some of my colleagues were less than happy to make a nomination. At least that's what the papers said. And we required 35 nominations. We started off brilliantly with 11. And then we had a huge increase in support when it went up to 12, when I nominated myself. And after that, it grew very slowly. And then it grew a bit quicker, and we finally passed that threshold not that long ago because of the decency and honesty of many of my colleagues who don't necessarily share all of our views on the way of the world or the party or the economy or many other things, but felt it was not their place to prevent members and supporters of the party having a debate and having a choice. And I genuinely and absolutely thank them for allowing this democratic process to take place. But I also thank many others who got onto the social media, pressurized and said, look, we are ordinary people. The Labour Party is the only avenue for our hopes, our dreams and our aspiration. Give us an opportunity to have a choice in this whole process. I thank all those thousands of people all over Britain who took part in that intensive week-long social media campaign. This is a campaign that's underway. Underway presenting alternative policies. None of them, not one of our documents, is the last word in anything. It's not intended to be. It's intended to open out ideas of how you look at things differently, how you look at the economy differently, how you look at social policy differently, and how you do things differently. Because I think people are a bit bored and a bit fed up with the politics of celebrity, the politics of top-down decision-making, the politics of abuse, counter-abuse, and counter-counter-abuse, and counter-counter-counter-abuse, and counter-counter-counter-counter-abuse. After that, you lose the will to live. And so, we make no individual criticisms of anybody. We make no personal abusive remarks. I don't care what anybody else says at any stage. We will reply with arguments for decency, for democracy, for justice, for socialism, and invite them to take part in an adult debate about how we run politics in our society. And because we're offering that space, that opening, that opportunity for so many people to come together, that's what makes it exciting. It's young people who are very political but not necessarily very attracted to party politics coming in. It's older people coming back. It's others saying, yeah, maybe there is something I, an individual, can do to improve our lot and change our lot in society. And it's very exciting what's going on. 600,000 people have signed up to be members, union registered supporters, or individual supporters in this election campaign. This, I think I'm right in saying, is the biggest ever democratic process the Labour movement has ever seen in which there is a real debate going on. That is something we can all be very proud of because we've all played a part in bringing that about. And what I would also say is that a big thank you to the unions. I'm proud to be a trade unionist. I'm proud to be a member of my union, Unison. I'm also a member of the NUJ. I used to be a union organiser before I became a member of Parliament. I don't apologise, and I'm not embarrassed by the link between the Labour Party and the trade unions. I'm proud of it because I see it as intrinsic to our life. There are 6 million people who are members voluntarily of trade unions in this country. And I thank Unite, Unison, communication workers, transport salaried staffs, train drivers, ASLEF, RMT, Bakers Union for all the support they've given us, and also the support that's been given by the Fire Brigades Union and many other individual members of other unions. And they've given us some financial support and some space to organise. And indeed, I thank the staff at the United Head Office for being the most unbelievably tolerant people. When on one evening last week we had 165 young people mainly coming in to do phone banking as part of our campaign. Imagine four rooms with 165 people in it, all talking on phones at the same time. It felt like Glasgow Station on a busy evening. It felt like anything else, but fantastic, and they're very tolerant of that. And we've raised over £100,000 to fund this campaign, and we've now raised enough money to be able to pay for a direct mail to all those people that are on this register. So we've raised that money by donations. The average donation is £20, £25, something like that. It's crowdfunding, it's people coming together trying to change things. I have to say, we've accepted absolutely no corporate donations of any sort. I should, however, add a health warning to that, to say we haven't actually been offered any either. But we're coping with that. And we have a big struggle ahead of us. The banking crisis of 2008, 2009, 2010 brought about the collapse virtually of our banking system. And the government of the day, the Labour government of the day, bought shares in banks, brought them into public ownership, put over £300 billion of quantitative easing in as a soft loan to those banks in order that the situation could carry on. I supported the public ownership of the banks. I believe the banks ought to remain in public ownership, and Osborne is totally wrong to sell off those shares in RBS that are being done at the moment. But, and this is a very big but, as a solution to that crisis, yes, the government did borrow a great deal of money. It had to. It had no real alternative or option to do that. But by setting an arbitrary date to move back into budget surplus, by setting an arbitrary date by which you'll pay down these debts, who suffered? We've seen the offers that were made in the 2010 election when our party was offering to make a lot of cuts in public expenditure after that election. The Tories and the Liberal Democrats have made huge cuts in the past 5 years, the consequences of which have been underfunding of services, sale of public assets, lower wages for many people, 0 hours contracts for many more, and the grotesque levels of inequality that we have in our society. We now have a Tory government with a small majority on its own. In 1 year, that government is proposing to sell off £30 billion worth of state assets, our bank shares, our buildings, our society. They're selling it off. Almost twice as the largest amount that Margaret Thatcher has ever sold off at the height of her privatisation mania. And there's an agenda there. Tax cuts for the very rich through inheritance tax, tax breaks for many companies, reducing corporation tax, a whole range of issues that will make us an even poorer and more unequal society. Saying to the children of young people, the last group that could go to university without fees and get a maintenance grant, no more. Ending the educational maintenance allowance, which was a passport into higher and further and higher education for so many young people, and punishing the children of large families by taking benefits away from the third child onwards. That is just the beginning of what this Tory government is about. And that is only basically a few weeks since the general election. Are we, as a party and a movement, to roll over and say, okay, you've got a majority of 12, you've got the support of nearly a quarter of the people in the whole country, we accept your mandate? No, sorry, we don't accept your mandate, because our job is to oppose the budget for what it does, to oppose The welfare reform bill, what an abuse of language that is. Oppose that welfare reform bill for what it has done and what it will do. And a welfare system that denies benefits to those that need them, that subsidises a combination of low rents by paying in-work benefits to people who are underpaid when they should be paid properly a decent minimum wage of £10 an hour, and the subsidy of high rents by their refusal to regulate the private rented sector anywhere in this country. And I represent a constituency that has almost a third of its population living in the private rented sector and having to pay very high rents. Because those rents are so high, because of the benefit cap, which has now been reduced still further, there is a process of social cleansing going on in every big city all over the UK by that process. So you see what happens. Poor working class families moved out, gentrification goes on, the community changes, and somehow or other, we as a society end up blaming the poor for being poor and for their own poverty rather than the way in which we run our society as a whole. And so we've got to oppose that. And I think it was completely wrong not to have a total vote against the welfare reform bill when it came before Parliament. And as far as I'm concerned, I will always vote against that bill. And then you look at the language that leads us into this. The sophistry around austerity, which somehow or other conjures up the idea that superpaid bankers with telephone number bonuses, funny how they need bonuses to work, but street cleaners don't get bonuses for keeping our streets clean. There's something the wrong way around in all of that. That the sophistry which then ends up saying, well, austerity's here, the welfare state's too expensive, public services are too expensive, cut back. There is a whole right-wing political agenda about diminishing the role of the community, diminishing the influence of the state on people's lives, except for the control aspects of it. So I think we have to offer something very different. And this election campaign offers us an opportunity to put forward those kinds of points of view. There is also the question of the demonisation of people. Owen has written so well on this in his book on chavs, in his book on the structure of British society. He's described it so well. We have a National Health Service free at the point of use as a human right, and it's the most brilliant thing. Sadly, being hollowed out, threatened, privatised where they can get away with it, and to be reduced to the health service of last resort. That is what they're trying to achieve with the NHS. I was in Tredegar the other day, and one can only be moved by the brilliance, the inspiration and the imagination that a miner and Aaron Bevan had of how we could have a National Health Service for everybody. If we don't defend it, nobody else will. If we don't stand up for it, it will be destroyed. Don't allow it to become the emergency room service of last resort. Make sure it forever remains our health service, our public service, free at the point of use, as the first port of call for everybody, as a basic human right. And that, we thank those that built it, we thank those that brought it to us. It's our duty, this generation, to defend it. But there's another aspect of society which is really under threat, and that is the principle of a cohesive society that cares for all. The whole principle in the Second World War behind the Beveridge Report was to eliminate destitution in our society, to build a society that cared for everybody. Somewhere along the line, we've allowed some of our newspapers and some people who should know better to describe people who legitimately access benefits to which we all willingly contribute through our taxation as scroungers, as people who are lifestyle benefit cheats, and we listen to that kind of language all the time. The result is we anaesthetise ourselves to the suffering and poverty of others. We anaesthetise ourselves to desperate people sleeping on the streets of every big city, to people with mental health conditions who've suffered all kinds of problems in their lives, former soldiers and many others who are leading a life of destitution. I say, obviously people should claim that to which they're entitled and shouldn't claim that to which they're not entitled. But we as a society should adopt the language of decency, of inclusion and humanity, and recognise every one of us is vulnerable. Every one of us can have catastrophes. Every one of us can have all kinds of problems in our lives. We might well, any of us, end up in that kind of situation. We don't pass by on the other side and avert our gaze. Let's be an inclusive society and be proud and prepared to stand up for that. And the other area that this government is so obsessed with is trade unions. There is a problem in the psyche of the Tory party and trade unions. It's been there for a very, very long time. The ancestors of the Tory party, well, not that long ago, only the 1830s, sentenced the 6 Tolpuddle martyrs to transportation for having the temerity to challenge the power of landowners. And from that was born the heroism of the Tolpuddle martyrs. From that came the growth of general unions, the Grand National Consolidated Trade Union and others. From that came the Chartists. From that came the growth of so much in our society. There's a clear democratic link. You expand the right to vote, you get some social progress. The 1832 Reform Act, you get the Factories Act not so long later. Widen the franchise, you get universal education, and so it goes on. Those brave people, which Owen referred to, that not only campaigned for all those social issues, but campaigned for the right of women to vote. And a great hero of Scotland, Keir Hardie, as the first leader of the Labour Party, campaigned for the right of women to vote. George Lansbury, another former leader of the Labour Party, resigned his constituency to fight a by-election on the right of women to vote. And the way in which those brave women, those suffragettes, campaigned. And those working class women that gave up all to ensure that future generations would have that right to vote. These are very important things. And so, on the back of that, we have to look at the kind of society that we want to create. They are attacking trade unions today by restricting the right to vote, by putting absurd barriers over decision making, by preventing unions spending their own members' money on that they want to spend it, and having any real influence in society. I'll be standing with the unions in opposing this piece of legislation, and I invite all of you to do the same. I also say that if we allow them to get away with this attack on trade unions, they will come for more, because they do not want people in the workplace to be organised. And the legacy of organised places, organised workplaces, is safer workplaces, is health and safety legislation, is less discrimination, is a better society. Yesterday I was given a badge by the Fire Brigades Union in memory of those people that died in Tianjin in China during the explosion at a chemical works. The firefighters that died trying to save others. The factory workers that died in a wholly preventable accident if there had been proper control, proper regulation and proper services in order to protect human life. That is where you need trade unions. That is where we need international trade union solidarity to support those people that are trying to form unions in often very difficult circumstances there, in Colombia, in Indonesia, in Malaysia, and so many other places. I don't know what the fourth part of the horse persons of the apocalypse is going to be. So far we've only had the budget, welfare reform and the trade union bill. Goodness knows what is lined up for us in September and thereon. If we are to defeat this government on its agenda and what it's doing, we've got to have some idea of where we're going ourselves, what kind of society we want, and, crucially, how we organise our own party and our own union. So we've offered up 10 suggestions And everything that we've offered up in this campaign is a consultation, is a proposal, is an idea. And it's open to everybody. Come back, say you don't agree, say you agree, say this bit's right, that bit's wrong, this is how you could do things differently. There's a lot of very, very brilliant people out there. Not just in universities and colleges, but everybody else. Everyone has ideas, and we can build a much stronger movement from that. So the first point of our 10 is the one I've already talked about. Opposition to austerity, but above all, an economic policy which is about a national investment bank to improve infrastructure within our society, to invest in people, invest in good quality jobs, invest to release the potential of so many highly skilled engineers and others that are so often underemployed or working way below their capacity at the present time. There is a very big role for public investment and public money to develop those industries and take things forward. So that will lead to an expanding, growing economy. Secondly, the stuff I've said about the Welfare Reform Act and the way in which we approach the issues of welfare. Thirdly, we live in a world that is in peril, an environment that is at risk, pollution levels that are unbelievable, and climate change that is absolutely happening. There are millions around the world whose livelihood is being destroyed through desertification, deforestation, floods, and many other things. We need to have an attitude of mind towards the natural world and the environment about how we conserve what we've got, use what we have more carefully, recycle what we can, reuse what we can, and look to the damage we're doing to biodiversity and ecosystems everywhere. It's very important, not just for us and this generation, but for future generations. So it's an attitude towards the environment, and how, as a government, I think we should approach it by international legally binding regulations on emissions, on the way in which the pollution takes place around the world, and how we protect our environment. Also, and this is the fourth point, how we look after not just our public services, but the role of public ownership. I think the railways should be in public ownership. I think they are a natural monopoly. And I would point out to those who say it all costs a great deal of money, I would quite simply say this. Yes, British Rail lost money, and British Rail was supported ineffectively and insufficiently very often, and it was privatised by John Major. As a result of privatisation, great profits have been made out of the rail network, bigger subsidies than ever are paid, and we, the public, are paying for the investment in new infrastructure. I absolutely welcome and support investment in the infrastructure, the electrification, the reopening of the Waverley line, at least in part, one day soon, I hope, it goes all the way to Carlisle and we get that line back. I hope that we invest in electrification north of the Central Belt in Scotland. I hope we invest in electrification of the Midland Main Line, the Leeds to Newcastle line, and so many others. I support all of that. But I think the train operating companies really ought to be publicly owned and publicly run, as East Coast Main Line was very successfully. So as each franchise ends, bring them back into public ownership. Likewise, Royal Mail is an absolutely natural monopoly. In a couple of years' time, Parliament will be invited again to discuss the question of a universal service obligation. If we don't keep a universal service obligation for Royal Mail, then remote towns, remote villages, highland places will not get any mail. Remote places will simply be cut off altogether, and other companies will come in and take over the easy bits of delivery in big cities. It's only a publicly owned and publicly run and publicly administered mail service that can guarantee mail for everybody at all times. Many have made points about housing, and I make all those points. Yes, there's a housing crisis in Britain. That housing crisis is created by a shortage of new building, a shortage of council housing, the lack of regulation of the private rented sector. Surely we can improve the lot of everybody by investing in council housing, controlling the private rented sector, and create a lot of jobs through that investment in building that council housing. There's a virtuous circle of improvement. The alternative is what? To have children growing up in bad quality private rented flats, there for 6 months, moving on, losing their home, losing their school, and going somewhere else. Underachieving, family breakup, and all those things that come about. Surely, those brave people, and I think of John Wheatley and many others, and indeed we have a council block named after John Wheatley in my constituency, who saw the reality and injustice of that housing system and wanted something better. Yes, we can do it, and yes, we will do it. The last points I want to make are these. I have spent my life campaigning on behalf of the people that are good enough to elect me to Parliament and for human rights and justice around the world. I am passionately opposed to the immorality of nuclear weapons and the holding of nuclear weapons. And come 2016, Parliament will have the opportunity to vote on the Maingate decision on Trident. I think we should say no, we're not going to replace Trident. And I would also say, and this is the important addition to it, quite simply this, that the £100 billion that would not be spent on Trident should instead be used to invest and kickstart high-quality, good engineering jobs. So the brilliant skills of those that make the submarines, make the missile systems, make the weaponry itself, are not lost. They're doing good things rather than making weapons of mass destruction. And it would put us in line with so many other countries around the world that have rejected nuclear weapons. And it's been my privilege to take part in conferences about it. But sometimes we discuss these things in a sort of rather intellectual, rather remote way, saying, well, on the one hand this, on the other hand that, on the other hand that, so if you have one nuclear weapon here, it'd be all right over there, it wouldn't really matter, it's okay. Yes, we'll have two. No. Just talk to nuclear test veterans, and I have spoken to them, British, French, Russian, American nuclear test veterans who were told to witness nuclear explosions in the 1950s and are still paying the price, and their children and their children's children are paying the price. The destruction of so much of the Pacific by those tests. One nuclear explosion anywhere in the world will set off a chain reaction which we don't know what the consequences of it are. Isn't it time we were prepared to stand up for the moral case against nuclear weapons and join South Africa and other countries that have given up nuclear weapons and take pride of place as being one of the big five to do just that? I opposed the invasion of Iraq in 2003, not because I was in any sense an apologist for Saddam Hussein. I just thought it was a catastrophically wrong decision to make. The consequences of wars are death, are destruction, are loss of life, and bitterness that grows in generation after generation, and the misery of the refugees. The war in Iraq, the war in Afghanistan, the war in Syria, the war in Libya, the war in Mali, and so many others create flows of refugees. Desperate people trying to survive. Desperate people looking for help. Children being brought up with limited education or none, insufficient food supplies, insufficient medicine, and lives that are very, very difficult. And so they try what anyone would do in those desperate situations to go somewhere else. Is the world's humanitarian answer going to be to pull up the drawbridge, put in the military and tell them all to go away? Or is it to say there are more displaced people around the world than at any time in recorded history? Don't the wealthy nations of Europe and North America have a very important role to play in trying to bring about peace, bring justice, stability and support to them so that they can lead good and useful lives? Is there any contribution to that debate made by statements from political leaders who should know better to describe desperate people living in a camp as a swarm? They're human beings, and we need a humanitarian response instead. I've said plenty about the National Health Service, and that, of course, is a major part of our campaign and our programme. I've said a lot about the need for positive rights at work, not just defeating the trade union bill. Positive rights to join a trade union. Positive rights to be able to go without being charged to an employment appeal tribunal. Positive rights to be represented by a trade union, even if they're not recognised at your place of work. We need to give workers greater protection at the workplace and encourage many young workers in the fast food industries, in call centres and so many other places, to come into trade union membership and understand the value of it. Our equalities legislation is good. The Human Rights Act was a huge step forward. The European Commission was a huge step forward. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights was a huge step forward. They are all at threat and all at risk at the present time. So, if we walk away from the Convention on Human Rights, we're in no position to criticise Russia or Hungary for their treatment of lesbian and gay people or their treatment of travellers and Roma people. We are not in a position to condemn human rights abuses if we destroy the very rights that we've given to ourselves by our own legislation. And the last point I'd make is that on education, and I'll finish on this. Education is something that we should value, not just for the training and the job opportunities it gives, though it obviously does that, but also the idea of education and learning for all. So we want to see every child with the opportunity of preschool socialisation, not based on the ability to pay or the poverty that gives them a free place, but all children able to come together in a nice atmosphere, preschool atmosphere, where they learn to interact with each other and understand each other before they go on to school a little bit later. It would make for a better society, and I think it would be absolutely the right thing to do. Let's not look upon children as commodities to make a profit out of. Let's look upon children as something that we all cherish and want to support in what they do. And then for education in school, in college, university, there are different systems across different parts of the UK. In those areas, particularly in England, where there are free schools and academies and the diminution of the role of the local education authority, we're suggesting the family of local schools, the family of local education, the accountability to a local education authority is something that is very, very important. So it means we don't end up with a marketplace and an internal competition market on education. Instead, we value and recognise the total provision. In some parts of the UK, students are paying fees. In England, limited to £9,000 a year, the Tories want to take the cap away. I've opposed fees all along. And it breaks my heart to meet new graduates stuck with a bill of £50,000 or £60,000 for working really hard to be qualified. If we raised corporation tax by 0.5%, we could remove the need for university fees altogether. I think it's a price worth paying. Our campaign is about justice, is about democracy, but above all, it's about turning politics around. So we do politics together. We dream together. We achieve together. We bring about a better society together by being inclusive of all. No more the name-calling. No more the abuse of the minority. No more the blaming of the poor for their poverty. Instead, let's look at sharing the resources that we've got, recognising those great people that founded our movement and gave us such inspiration. But above all, build our movement and our party, not just to fight elections, but to be that campaigning social force, that can challenge the Welfare Reform Act, the Trade Union Bill, the Budget, and all the other horrors that are coming down the line, so that generations to come will recognize this summer of 2015 was the summer our movement changed, was the summer that politics changed, was the summer that people stood up, as they are in Europe, as they are in the United States, and said, we're not leaving the world to be run by the experts in the multinational corporations. Instead, we want the world to be run for the good of all, not the enrichment of the few. Thank you very much.